So what I'm going to do is I tell you a bit about what we are doing on silverfish gastrulation. And assuming that not everyone has seen a gastrulated fish embryo, I put in this movie here just to show you what gastrulation in a fish embryo looks like. So what we are looking at is a fish embryo at the onset of its life. It consists of a very big yolk cell, which is approximately 500 micrometer in diameter, and two cells. And out of the two cells, all of the embryo is going to develop. And so essentially what life starts in fish embryos is you have a lot of cleavages up there, basically subdividing the volume of these two cells into smaller parts. That eventually leads to the formation of the blastoderm at around sphere stage, 4 hours. And then the blastoderm starts to spread around the yolk cell. You get mesoderm and endoderm cells on the inside, and you get accumulation of blastoderm cells on the dorsal side, and essentially axis formation. So just once more, so you have cleavages initially subdividing the volume of the two, one cell, the fertilized cell, at the beginning. This leads to the formation of the blastoderm, and then the blastoderm starts to spread around the yolk cell. You get mesoderm, endoderm to the inside, ectoderm to the outside, you have convergence movement, then you have axis formation. That's roughly what is happening during gastrulation, and that's what we try to understand from a mechanical point of view. I put in these stills here, and I stole the schematic diagrams from Walcott's principle of development, just to show you what the main types of tissue rearrangements and cell movements are during gastrulation. So some people claim gastrulation starts at this stage here, which is sphere. The embryo is approximately 4 hours old, and it ends at around 9 to 10 hours. And that's the different types of movements we have during gastrulation. This is now a schematic diagram of the embryo up here, and essentially the embryo consists of a blastoderm, approximately 1,000 cells, and then we have the yolk cell on which the blastoderm sits. And then the first type of morphogenetic movement we have in gastrulation is spreading of the blastoderm around the yolk cell, and that's typically called epiphyly or doming movements. And that's being sort of assumed to be triggered by deep cells undergoing radial intercalation, active radial intercalation. So basically, cells deep within the blastoderm moving up into more superficial layers, undergoing intercalation, and then thereby spreading the blastoderm along this dimension here and thinning along the z-axis. Right? So this is essentially doming and epiphyly movements. And then the most important thing in gastrulation is to bring mesoderm and endoderm cells to the inside, and that's thought to be triggered by a signal which is sort of localized in equatorial regions of the yolk cell, and which encode neural TGF-beta signals, secreted signals. And they act on these marginal cells here, down here, and they convert these cells from a sort of default ectoderm fate into mesoderm and endoderm cells. So the marginal cells, which are originally exposed to the nodal TGF-beta signals, they're becoming mesoderm and endoderm. And once they are becoming mesoderm and endoderm, they're undergoing something which, you know, resembles an epithelial mesenchymal transition. It's not a real epithelial mesenchymal transition, but these cells essentially become migratory and mesenchymal. Once these cells are becoming migratory and mesenchymal, they move to the inside, they ingress, and they form the mesenderm cell layer on the inside. And the cells which are not making it to the inside, they become ectoderm. So essentially, what you do is during gastrulation, you transform an embryo which has a single layer, uniform single layer, into an embryo in silverfish, which consists of two main tissue layers, an outer layer, which is the ectoderm, and the inner layer, which becomes mesoderm. Now, this is sort of the key step here, and then you have still to bring all the cells to one side to form the body axis and extend the body axis. And this type of rearrangement is typically called convergence and extension. And that means that cells are from more lateral and bent positions move over towards the dorsal side. And once they are arriving at the dorsal side, these cells are sort of meeting at the dorsal side. And then they are undergoing medial lateral intercalations. And these medial lateral intercalations lead to the extension of the frontal body axis along the anterior posterior axis of the frontal area. So I hope that's roughly clear. What I would like to do is then in the next approximately hour and a half is tell you a bit about these type of movements, probably the most simple type of movements, how, you know, the blastoderm starts to spread around the yolk cell. And I will tell you a bit about mesoderm and endoderm cells coming in and moving upwards and how these two tissue layers to interact to this ingression movement and Miserere, because they are essentially moving in opposite directions, as you can see here. Miserere moves upwards and Eckler moves downwards. There's some interaction, mechanical interaction between these surveys, which is important for morphogenesis of the embryo.
Can you really talk about that early as a single cell layer with EVL? Is EVL just a decoration, or do you?
Yes. I didn't mention EVL. So the EVL is basically a skin which surrounds the blastoderm and makes contact directly to the yolk cell. And I will tell you a bit more about the EVL as well. And the EVL, the single strain epithelial cell, are the only truly epithelial cells in the embryo. Cells below are non-epithelial cells, they are not fluorescent on the epithelial axis. And the mesoderm and endoderm cells are probably the least epithelial cells because they're really migratory in the second But the only truly epithelial cells are the enveloping EVL cells on the outside, which are sort of a protective skin on the outside, but you know, essentially I will tell you a bit later that they're quite important for many morphogenetic movements during gastrulation. Thank you. Okay, so the first thing I would like to tell you about is what I, you know, very generally call here complex tissue spreading, meaning spreading of the EVL and the underlying deep cells together during the movement of donor activity. And quickly to acknowledge the guy who has done pretty much all the work I'm speaking about, that's Hitoshi, and he's on the back. he is an incredibly talented experimentalist. He can do all sorts of experiments which I never managed to do. And he was supported by another postdoc, which is a shared postdoc between my lab and the lab of the group of Guillaume Salvoli at the Crick Institute, Sylvia. And she's a theorist, and I'll tell you a bit about what she has done together with Hitoshi. Okay, complex tissue spreading. What I meant with complex tissue spreading is essentially the process of doming and epiphyllium. Now, you're looking here at the schematic diagram of an embryo. Now you can see only the EVL, the outside, this thin layer of epithelial squamous epithelial cells sitting basically on the surface of the deep cells, which are below. And if you look at a cross-section, and I just put this movie in here, you can see that EVL moves downwards, it spreads the movement downwards, and you have the deep cells which are moving together somehow with the overlying EVL. It's actually quite interesting, if you want, so SE system to understand how mesenchymal deep cells and epithelial surface cells and motor layer of epithelial surface cells move together in a coordinated way to achieve the spreading of the blastoderm over the yolk cell. But so we thought we need to look a bit closer into how that is being mechanically achieved. And essentially what we did is we looked at the very early step of epiphyllae, which is in zebrafish called doming. You will see now in the movie why that has been called doming. Essentially, what the embryo consists of at this stage, again, is a very big yolk cell. And then you have the blastoderm. The blastoderm is subdivided into deep cells, which are more mesenchymal. And then, which something which you can't see on this DSC image, you have a monolayer squamous epithelial cells on the outside. And this is essentially the process we would like to understand in this movie. So it appears as if the yolk cell now domes, moves into the blastoderm, and the blastoderm starts to spread around the yolk cell. Essentially, what is happening in this process is the blastoderm spreads around the yolk cell, and now the yolk cell is pushing upwards. But, so this is a process which has been noted and, of course, described for many, many years in the zebrafish field, and there were different ideas around how that is being achieved. The most sort of popular idea, and you know that's what is still being entertained by most people, is that these deep cells are undergoing gradient intercalations. Essentially, if you look at the cross-section of these deep cells here, what is, you know, would be a multi-layer tissue, and then what has been proposed is the cells speak within the blastoderm and are moving up into more superficial layers, and what they do is they undergo gradient intercalations, and by undergoing gradient intercalations, you essentially thin the tissue along a dimension here, which would be the z-axis, and you spread the tissue along the remaining two dimensions, which are the XY dimensions of the tissue. So active intercalation of deep cells, and that assumes that these cells are actually active migratory cells, or certainly some locomotion at least, and it would sort of, one would have to assume that these cells have a polarity along the axis, otherwise they would not be able to move along the axis.
Just a quick question. So the volume is conserved between the different parts of the module. I mean, the yawl can...
Yes. I mean, essentially, the volume of the yawl and the blast zone are not drastically changing because of the supply change, but it's not a very significant change in volume.
Do you know what signal defines radial?
Sorry?
What molecular signal defines radial?
The most likely candidate for that is that, the short answer, we don't know exactly how these cells are finding the radial axis. I think most likely it's an apical basal axis, because essentially the outside is apical of these cells, and the inside is somehow basal. And then you would somehow...
And that propagates somehow.
And then somehow you have to propagate it over this one epithelial cell layer to the inside. I think that's the most likely explanation. But I will tell you a bit more about how we... but that's a key question, I think. So radiate acylations have been sort of the predominant mechanism proposed, and there was also an interesting paper, more than 20 years old now, which, for very little justification, random justification, they proposed there must be some pushing force coming from the yawl cell, pushing up that's into the blastoderm, and this pushing force is essentially triggering the spreading of the blastoderm over the yawl cell. So both ideas were out, but there was no clear answer which one is actually the force generating mechanism triggering doming movements. Now, what we did is to sort of address these different mechanisms, we looked at doming in a slightly more quantitative manner, and the first thing we tried to quantify is the degree of radiate acylation, the degree of movement of cells along the radial axis within the blastoderm. This again would be a schematic diagram of an embryo at the onset of doming and once doming is underway at the end of doming. And basically what we did here is we looked at the movement of beep cells along the radial axis, the radial speed of beep cells within the blastoderm. And the time point zero here, this is in minutes, the time point zero would be the onset of visible doming, meaning that this interface between the yawl cell and the blastoderm is starting to wire up. Right? And clearly, deep cells are starting to undergo active radiant integrations once doming is set. Then, just to quantify the extent of doming, we just looked at the area between the blastoderm and the yawl cell and changes in this interfacial area between blastoderm and the yawl cell. And that's not surprisingly, because that's the definition of doming, is setting in at zero at the onset of doming. Interestingly, if you look at the EVL, this frames the epithelial cell layer, at the onset of doming at 0 minutes, there is a pronounced increase of approximately 10% in the surface area of EVL cells, indicating that EVL cells, EVL increases its surface area. Essentially, these cells are spreading out and becoming flat and increase the apical surface area. So you have radiant acylations, you have doming movement, you have the buckling of this interface, and you have spreading of EVL cells. So all these events which have been somehow involved in doming or happening during doming, that was sort of comforting. And so the first thing you want to know is, how do you get the shape of the embryo at the onset of doming? The most simple model which we sort of developed together with Viom is a model where we just assume that the interfacial tendons determine the shape of the embryo at the onset of doming. And essentially you have a triple point or a contact line between the blastoderm and the yawl cell. And at this contact line, the forces which are given by the interfacial tensions in steady state must be all balanced. And essentially, we're looking at the surface tension of the blastoderm, which pulls upwards here. You look at the surface tension of the yawl cell, which pulls predominantly downwards. And we have an interfacial tension between the blastoderm and the yawl cell. And at steady state, these forces must add up to zero. So you can basically then construct a phase diagram, and you can ask at which distribution of interfacial tensions would I get an embryo which looks like an embryo at the onset of doming. And the take-home message from that is, and this is a pure prediction, is you have to go below one when you look at the ratio of blastoderm to yawl cell surface tension. Essentially, you have to assume that blastoderm surface tension becomes smaller than yawl cell surface tension. Then you're getting into a regime where the embryo, where this interface is buckling upwards, and you get a shape which looks like an embryo at the onset of doming. You also have to assume that the ratio of the interfacial tension between the blastoderm and the yawl cell and the surface tension of the yawl goes below one. For this, we have very little experimental ways of addressing it. We assume that is happening. For this one, we can actually look, we can do experiments and measure that correctly. The way we are doing these experiments is, yep.
I guess that
the volume also should play a role, because the Laplace appreciation depends on the radius of your domain.
So you plug in
the real volume that you measure from the York and the...
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, the volume is not changing. It remains pretty much constant. There's a little increase of the Blasterdam volume, but it increases together with the York volume. The relative volumes stay constant. Okay, so this is the way we're measuring the surface tension of the blastoderm and the surface tension of the York cell. Essentially, you're just putting the embryo at the onset of doming between two plates, and then we're moving one plate onwards. And we're recording the force, which is up here. And this is the compression force, which acts on the upper plate here. And we're looking at the deformation of the blastoderm to the upper plate and the deformation of the York cell to the lower plate. And via the contact area and the angle we have here, we can then calculate the surface tension. And we do that once the force has reached equilibrium up here. And then we get a ratio of surface tensions between the blastoderm and the York cell at the onset of doming to see if the assumption that this is that the blastoderm has a lower surface tension than the York cell is actually true. Now, this is what we got then experimentally, and we are not far off this, that indeed the blastoderm has a lower surface tension than the York cell, and that we are getting into a regime where doming can, in principle, happening, where the shape of the embryo at the onset of doming would be pretty good. So that basically tells us that we are looking at interfacial tensions is a valid one, and we can predict shapes of embryos at the onset of doming. What we then did is we assumed two different scenarios for which you can then go from this initial shape into active dynamic doming movements depending on the blastoderm or the York cell. One mechanism would be that we're assuming that there's active EVL cell expansion. And then the EVL actively expands and reduces surface tension of the blastoderm. And when the surface tension of the blastoderm is being reduced, we get movement of the contact line down. That was the assumption. And what we did then, we did simulations using this assumption to see if that can recapitulate the shapes or the shape changes of embryos during doming. What we found in these simulations is something which looks a bit like doming, but not really like doming. I mean, you see that this interface is going upwards, and then the EVL is moving downwards, but the blastoderm is not really moving together with the EVL. So there's some sort of uncoordination between EVL and blastoderm. It's indicating that this assumption that doming is being driven by a reduction of surface tension of the blastoderm does not really hold true. Presumably, it's not sufficient to explain how doming is being achieved in the embryo. We then turn to the original hypothesis, which was around for many years, and we assume that there might be an active contraction of the deep cell layer given by a radial intercalation of deep cells, and that this active contraction of the deep cell layer leads to doming movements, to a thinning of the blastoderm along its radial axis and then extend along the XY dimensions. And we did these simulations, that we got embryo shapes which looked much better than what we saw by just assuming that the surface tension is being reduced. So at this stage, we favored the model that doming is being driven by active contraction of the deep cell, because the simulations just matched much better what we saw experimentally than just assuming that the reduction of blastoderm surface tension is doing this process. Now, we want to see if deep cells are indeed undergoing active intercalation. So we did a couple of movies and just show you two exemplary movies. Now we're looking at an embryo during doming. This would be the EVLs, the strains of the EVL cells up there. And we're looking at rearrangements of cells right below the EVL, assuming that this intercalation behavior should be visible. And indeed, we can see that cells are moving actively up and down. You can see this cell moves downwards and another cell moves upwards. So there's a lot of, the take-home message from this movie would be there's a lot of rearrangements happening, which would be somehow consistent with the idea that cells are motor declarations. It's not really proving that this is radio declarations, but cells at least are motor.
So what would you need to see to feel confident calling it radial contraction? I'm not sure exactly what you mean by this.
So radial contraction would be that cells are undergoing actively radial intercalations, thereby contracting, leading to generation of a radial stress within the deep cell layer and contracting the deep cell layer along the way.
So it would have to be directional.
It has to be directional.
And from these movies that you showed, we're not sure.
No, these movies you cannot say that they're directional. They have been, we're not the first ones looking at deep cell radial intercalation. They have been very detailed signs, and there's good evidence that the preferential movement direction of deep cells is indeed one of the radial axis.
Is it a technical problem that it's very...
It's not a technical problem, but we just didn't want to repeat it. But we could have done. Okay, so from these experiments, from the simulations, and you know, looking at the active behavior of cells within the deep cell layer, deep cell active radio intercalation of deep cells seem to be sort of the favorite model. So Hitoshi wanted to test that by doing you know, one very simple experiment. What he did is he took an embryo, and then he took out approximately 70% of the deep cells and replaced the deep cells with an embryo. Assuming if he takes out the deep cells, then you wouldn't have radio contraction of the deep cell layer anymore, because you don't have these deep cells anymore. And in such a case, if radio contraction of the deep cell layer is indeed causing doming, doming should be strongly inhibited or stalled completely. Now, that's the experiment he did. Is you can nicely see that not very many deep cells were left in these experiments. These are big gaps which are filled now with embryo buffer. And to his and my big surprise, these embryos were actually undergoing perfect doming. You can see very nicely that the base goes up. And essentially, you know, with an embryo which lacks large part of its deep cell layer, you know, doming is still acute.
I'm a little confused as to what you mean by radial. You mean normal to the surface of the outer layer?
So essentially going from the center point up, outwards,
center,
right?
The whole thing? Okay. Like a sphere.
Like the sphere. Okay, so this experimentally showed us that at least a large part of the deep cell layer is dependent for doming, indicating that active contraction of the deep cell layer might not be the main driving force triggering doming.
When you remove those deep cells, why doesn't the EVL just collapse on top of the cells?
Because we replace it with buffer. So the volume is being, so we're just putting the same amount of volume which we have taken out in again in the buffer.
Why doesn't the buffer just leak out of the EVL?
Because the EVL is tight. The
If you remove the EVL, do you have doming?
I'm coming to that now. This is exactly the experiment, thank you. What we did is we turned to a mutant here, which we are a different solution. So the formation of a stain with the cell layer on the outside of the surface of the blastoderm is being detected. The mutant in a gene which is called IKK1, the E signaling pathway, and for some reason which nobody understood and still understands, the EVL doesn't properly form on the surface of the blastoderm. So in such a case, you would have not a proper EVL on the surface. You were wondering if in a mutant which doesn't have an EVL and consequently no EVL expansion, would doming still occur? And you know, you can already see in this movie that doming is strongly inhibiting these embryos. And this is just a quantification of the interfacial area between the York cell and the blastoderm and the readout of the degree of doming. And in Koki, in the mutant embryos and this mutant embryo, doming is being very strongly inhibited, while in wild-type embryos doming is normal. So we have an embryo in hands now in which doming doesn't work and surface cell differentiation is being defective. It doesn't tell us, because this is a pure coincidence, that the defective differentiation of EVL surface cells and the EVL surface cell expansion is really triggering doming. So we have to do a couple of more sophisticated experiments about them. Hitoshi then managed to do is an experiment where he can transplant EVL cells. And he does it between mutant and wild type. And that's something which nobody has achieved yet in supervision. He seems to be the only one who can do that at the moment. That is taking wild type EVL cells and putting it onto a mutant, poking mutant embryo, and trying to rescue them in these guys. And doing the reverse experiment, taking out these weird surface cells from a mutant embryo, which are not EVL, and putting it onto a wild type embryo and see if he can inhibit it. And that was his idea. And that's an example where Hitoshi put wild-type cells onto a poking mutant embryo. This embryo is completely mutant, except these transplanted EVL surface cells onto a mutant embryo. What he found is that right below the patch, you form a very visible dome. That's a very good indication that these surface cells presumably trigger doming. And that's just a quantification of the extent of doming. He's just looking now at this area here, and you get a very nice rescue of the doming movements below the patch, but only below the patch of transplanted surface cells. You can do the reverse experiment where he puts now mutant surface cells, which are not EVL, onto an otherwise completely wild-type embryo, and he's asking, would that inhibit doming? And that's exactly what is happening in this movie. You can see very nicely that the dome is strongly inhibited, dome formation is strongly inhibited right below the patch of transplanted mutant cells, indicating that once you put mutant cells, which are detected in expansion, when Boeing is being inhibited, and once you put wild-type cells on, which are competent with expansion, then you can rescue Boeing and then you can have it.
So the Pokemon mutant has an EBL, but it is a defective.
It has pseudocells, and these cells are actually epithelial cells, but they are not expanding. So these are, you know, weird epithelial cells on the outside, which don't behave. They are not kind of squamous. They are sort of choroidal epithelial cells on the outside, which have a problem. And essentially, they are not expressing keratins, and keratins seem to be required for making cells more squamous and spreading. Okay, so playing BT mutants and wild types can be problematic, and you know some referees don't like that. So what we want to do is an experiment where we're just using the same genotype. And essentially, the experiment which Hitoshi did then in this case is he takes wild type server cells, which are overexpressing constitutive active form for A, assuming that these server cells are very contractile and cannot expand, and put it and replace normal wild type cells with these expanded effective for A overexpressing server cells. Again, a quite tricky experiment, and what he found is that below this, overexpressing the ORA, he can transiently inhibit dominant in these areas, indicating that it's not something weird coming from the mutant, but simply inhibiting expansion of wild-type surface cells is sufficient to inhibit dominant in these areas. It's just a quantification of that, again, the extent of this area, and you get a transient delay in dominant in these mutant areas. You can do the reverse experiment, and now transplant mutant cells onto mutant embryos, and the mutant cells he's transplanting now are overexpressing myosin phosphatase, which inhibits contraction of these cells, and which allows these mutant cells now to expand. And what is happening in such a case is, again, that you can see very nicely below the patch of transplant cells, he can transiently re-trigger dome formation, indicating that when he allows mutant cells to expand, doming is being rescued, and that it's really the expansion which triggers doming and not anything else in the mutant versus wild type which might be interfering with doming. The last experiment, and that was still not sufficient, we thought about one experiment that can really go away from any sort of molecular interference, and you know the experiment he did here is he takes a very large patch of surface cells, mutant surface cells, and replaces a smaller patch of mutant surface cells with a larger patch. So this is not your annual expression or as in phosphatase or mutant or anything. He's just basically increasing the surface area. And when he puts these cells on, he again gets the formation from the tapetome right below the transplanted cells. Then the embryo eventually explodes for whatever reasons. But all these experiments essentially support the idea that the expansion of surface cells is a very critical feature of to let the embryo Now, at this point, I, being a biologist, was convinced that we have solved the problem and that surface cells are doing all the job. But talking to a few other people in the lab, predominantly physicists, they told me that there's a problem in these transplantation experiments. And the obvious problem we have in these experiments is that what we do is we very locally suppress filming and we locally induce filming. But essentially, in these transplantation experiments, what we would do is we would globally change surface tension of the blastoderm. You would assume, simply by assuming that you either globally increase surface tension of the blastoderm or decrease surface tension of the blastoderm, you should get a homogeneous inhibition or activation of doming below. So the locality of this effect is not something you would simply predict from the theoretical conservation science course as well. So, Guillaume joined us again to see what could be the reason that we get such local effects rather than global effects as you would expect. And the most sort of plausible explanation we came up is that what is happening in a case where we have transplanted wild-type cells onto a mutant embryo, for example, is that we are not only globally reduced EBL surface tension, or calcium surface tension, but that we also locally increase radial deep cell layer contraction right below the patch of transplanted cells. Only in such case we get in similes and shapes where we can locally trigger doming right below the transplanted patch. And conversely, this is exactly the same when we are doing the compress experiment where we're putting a mutant onto wild type. And we will get these local effects only if we assume that there's a global increase in the EBL surface tension and that this leads to a local decrease in the concentration here. So the question that we have is, you know, how would expansion of surface cells trigger active intercalation of deep cells? We don't have a very clear answer to this question yet. I mean, the closest we can get to this problem is that what we realized is once these surface cells are expanded, the density of cells right below proper EVL surface cells in the right-up embryo goes down. And if you compare that to a mutant embryo, the density is higher. And the idea would be here that once the surface cells are expanding, you're basically allowing the deep cells to get, the density of deep cells to go down. And when the density of deep cells goes down, you can trigger motility of deep cells. And you have to assume that there's on top of it some polarity of the deep cells, which would lead to a local induction of radio, active radio integration of deep cells. That's a very vague explanation, and you know, we don't have much more evidence for that. But that would be probably the closest we can get to explain how expansion of surface cells triggers active integration of deep cells.
You were saying that the deep cell is more like a mesenchyme. What's between them? Is there any cell?
Yes. So this is exactly the point. So deep cells, initially at the onset of dorming, has very little in between. They are just adjacent to each other, and they appear like a tear-mediated cell cell adhesion to each other. And there's very little space between deep cells. At the onset of dorming, when EVL starts to spread out, what you see at the same time is the accumulation of interstitial fluid between deep cells. This is not extracellular matrix or anything else, it's simply interstitial fluid. So what you do is you somehow trigger interstitial fluid accumulation leading to a smaller density, cell density in the area than EVL is expanding. But you can assume various mechanisms for that. You can assume that there's water transport from the outside to the inside, there's molarity gradient in the EVL. You can assume that there's some other effects by deep cells losing, shrinking, and giving some fluid to the outside, and this leads to the formation of interstitial fluid. We don't know essentially. But what we observe is simply that interstitial fluid starts to accumulate when dorming is underway. But no extracellular matrix in this stage. No, I mean, there is some extracellular matrix, but no visible accumulation between cells. Okay. So just to finish on this part here, what we propose is that EVL expansion triggers dorming by reducing plastic term surface tension, yet increasing radial deep cell layer contraction. And essentially, you take these two effects into account, and you combine them in the simulations we do together with Guillaume, you can arrive exactly at shape changes we observe in the hypothermia. And we assume that these two things are equally contributing to the dorming, then we're seeing that we can essentially simulate dorming in a way it's happening in the hypothermia. Okay, so I'm pretty much at the end, and this is just summarizing what I just told you before, that the blastoderm surface tension reduction drives dorming, radial deep cell layer contraction facilitates dorming, and EVL expansion triggers both blastoderm surface tension reduction and active radial integration of deep cells.
So in these simulations, do you enforce the spherical or the circular shape of the embryo and only track the internal boundary, or is the external boundary also a variable?
What do you mean, this external boundary, the surface
so
of the...
In the shape transformation, there is doming that makes the yolk occupy a larger portion of space. But there is also, overall shape of the embryo remains circular or spherical.
Yeah.
Is this circular or spherical shape enforced, or it emerges naturally from solving the problem?
I think it is enforced in this case, and pretty much coincides with the actual shape of the embryo. So the other thing
Question. I was wondering how many dimensions per meter this model have, and how did you infer them from?
So this is a three-dimensional model. It's not a two-dimensional model we have here.
No. It's dimensionless parameters. How many parameters?
So what we are putting in here is the viscosity of the EVL, the viscosity of the blastoderm, and the viscosity of the yolk cell. And then we are playing with the surface tension reduction of the blastoderm. And we assume from the measurements that's something we see that the surface tension of the yolk cell is not changing during dorming. And then we are putting radial stress into the blastoderm to see to what degree do we need that. The experiment we can measure with viscosity of blastoderm. That's something we did by fusion of blastoderm expands. We have taken blastoderm expands and then fused. We look at the viscosity of blastoderm, the viscosity of blastoderm, and the viscosity of the yorks that we assumed to be much smaller than the viscosity of blastoderm. But we have, in the meantime, some measurements where you can, you know, put that more precisely. Okay, so the other thing I would like to tell you about is the generation of friction forces in sea-fish constellation and how friction forces can contribute to constellation movements. And the work down here is mainly done by Michael Smutny. He's very difficult to see, but he is on the back here. And he did, together with Cheyenne Sylvia again in Guillaume's group in Suda. He was in Tamás Pitschek's group in Budapest. Now, the interest which we, why we start to look at friction forces came from looking at a mutant. And this mutant is called maternal psychotic monad pinnate mutant embryos. And these embryos, the main defect is that they don't have a mesoderm in the middle. They essentially only consist of ectoderm cells. What has been noted, and you know, that's, you know, for many years has been noted that if you look at the shape of MZOP mutant compared to the shape of the wild type embryo at the end of constellation, they look dramatically different. I mean, that's pretty obvious to everyone who looks at these. But nobody has really explained why this embryo is so thick and short and why normal, you know, and so different from a normal embryo, which is extended. So we were wondering whether the defective extension of mutant embryo somehow, how does it relate to the absence of mesoderm embryo in these mutant embryos? Would there be a contribution of mesoderm embryo to the axis conjugation essentially? What we precisely looked at is the position of the neural plate, the anterior edge of the neural plate, which is forming above the axis of the embryo, and we were asking if the position of the neural plate depends on the presence of mesoderm in the embryo. And what you can see is the neural plate, if you're looking at the dorsal picture now on the lateral, the anterior neural anlage is essentially at the animal pole of the wild type embryo. And if you look in a mutant embryo, it's shifted posteriorly up to the ventral pole of the automatic head. So essentially what we ask is mesoderm an endoderm, which you know, is visible here, dark blue, and absence in the mutant, is that for correct positioning of new ectoderm cells within the embryo? Specifically, what the type of mesoderm you're looking at is the most anterior axial mesoderm. Now you're looking at an embryo right at the mid-gastrulation approximately. You can see that mesoderm and endoderm cells have already ingressed. And if you're looking here at the axis, this would be notochord. And this piece up here of mesoderm would be the precordal plate. It's the anterior axial mesoderm of the embryo. Okay? This piece of the mesoderm underlies this neural plate I showed you before, right? This anterior neural anlage. And you were basically asking how would precordal plate interact with the overlying new ectoderm cells to allow correct positioning of the anterior neural anlage in a wild type embryo. Is that clear to everyone what we're looking at? So we're looking at precordal plate tissues, we're looking at ectoderm above, and we're basically asking when the precordal plate migrates upwards, and then the new ectoderm cells are moving downwards, would the interaction between these two tissues have an effect on the movement of the ectoderm cells above? In a side view, just to show you that once more, so if you're looking now at the side view, this would be the precordal plate up here, and the ectoderm moves downwards in the movement of pivoli, and the precordal plate moves upwards, and it has rest, it's actively migrating upwards. And then, magnification, that's again what is actually happening. You see the mesoderm precordal plate moving in this direction and the new ectoderm moving downwards, and you have a very interesting interaction between these two cells. There's nothing, you know, in between. There's no basal lamina, anything formed in between these cells making correct cells are contact. The question is, would this interaction between these cells explain the specific positioning of the ectoderm cells within the new plant? Okay, so the first thing is we look a bit closer at this interface between mesoderm or precordal plate and new ectoderm. And this is at mid-gastrulation, approximately 60% of the tibia. And the green cells are the precordal plate cells, and the red cells up here are the new ectoderm cells. What we find is that the precordal plate cells make direct contact with the new ectoderm cells. And at the site of contact between precordal plate and new ectoderm, there's cationic, e-cationic localization, indicating that there's direct cell-cell adhesion between pre-contact cells and neuroendocrine cells mediated by them. These tissues are moving in opposite directions, and at the interface where they're moving along, they make contacts, transient contacts, presumably, which are mediated by the EKG. No, so none of them has a clear apical basal priority. The only cells are the EBL cells, which you can't see, and the alpha, which are really so there's no clear apical basal priority. We thought about there might be something, but there's nothing, you know, if you look at APC or LGL, nothing really permits. There's also no large amounts of interstitial fluid accumulation between these cell layers. There's interstitial fluid up here and below here, but there's very little in between at this interface between pre-contact and the ectoderm. Okay, now the first thing is we asked how would the ectoderm cells behave in a wild embryo versus an embryo which doesn't have a pre-contact, and it's MZ over P mutant embryos. Here we're looking at the pre-color plate in a wild-type embryo moving upwards, and basically what we're looking at here is the flow profile of new ectoderm cells. This is velocity, micrometer per minute, and this is the pre-color plate which moves upwards, and you can see that this causes this kind of swirl movement of the ectoderm cells. So basically, what the pre-color plate is doing, it's redirected to the new ectoderm cells, which usually move downwards, upwards, and then you get these large vortices forming right ahead of pre-contact.
Is the character of the ectoderm different in these? I mean, the one I tend to have mutant is defective in nodal signaling.
Yeah.
Probably doesn't make
the MP. This is the mutant embryo. Everything goes downwards, right? There's no. Yeah, they essentially all move downwards. Right?
I'm saying the nodal signaling will specify BMP inhibitors, which are necessary for actually making their ectoderm. So aren't the tissues also, besides the movements you're looking at, aren't these tissues totally molecularly different?
So you're essentially asking if nodal signaling within the ectoderm loses something to the ectoderm.
We know that there's extensive signaling interactions between the mesoderm and the right. That
absolutely.
The Spayman organizer equivalent in fish is necessary for converting the neural tissue, and now you're, in addition to perturbing movement, you're also changing the cell fate identities of all these things. Yep. So how do you separate those two effects?
Yep. Not at this stage, I will tell you on this stage. But yeah, you know, this stage you cannot say anything. I mean, it could be all secondary to the rule using factor XY, which is, again, required for proper movement of the ectoderm cells. Essentially, the only take-home message you can have here is once you have a pre-colored plate, the new ectoderm cells move considerably different to a case where you don't have a pre-colored plate. Will be more precise. Once you have nodal signaling, the ectoderm is completely different from the case where you don't have nodal signaling. Okay. I think that's probably the most precise statement here. So you can quantify these kind of effects, and you can look at one of the things where the pre-colored plate moves upwards, and then the ectoderm cells are being redirected above the pre-colored plate. If you look at a velocity profile, the movement, the positive movements would be movement downwards, and the negative velocities would be movement upwards, and the pre-colored plate moves upwards, the green ones, and the new ectoderm is being redirected right above the pre-colored plate, is being redirected and then moves upwards together with the pre-colored plate, right? In a mutant embryo, which is protected from nodal signaling and doesn't have a pre-colored plate, all the new ectoderm cells are basically moving downwards in a positive velocity. So very clearly there are differences in the movement of the ectoderm cells in wild-type versus nodal signaling defective mutant embryos. And in a nutshell, that's what it looks like. If in a wild-type embryo, the ectoderm cells do these large vortices, the cells ahead of the pre-colored plate being redirected, and then they're moving over, and then they're moving downwards. And in a mutant embryo, essentially all the cells are moving downwards. Okay, so if you wanted to know if the movement and not the presence of the pre-colored plate is important for these effects, so distinguishing between nodal signaling and actual movements here. What we're doing is we're looking at a mutant, which is a mutant in the wing, PC2 pathway, wing 11, in which pre-colored plate cells are normally induced. We have the same number of pre-colored plate cells. But what is happening is that the velocity of pre-colored plate cells, the movement upwards, the velocity of movement over the end of pool, and the directionality of the movement, so instantaneous speed, and directionality is being reduced. So in such a region, you have non-induction of these endoderm, but the pre-colored plate doesn't move correctly anymore. And the question is then, would that lead to changes in the effect on the new ectoderm above? And these are the flows of the ectoderm. Essentially, what you can see is usually a wild-type embryo, this red line would go downwards together with the pre-colored plate and would be moving upwards, essentially. And in a case where the velocity is being reduced, the direction is being reduced for the free body plane, this effect is very strongly diminished. Essentially, what you're ending up is a scenario where the new ectoderm still moves downwards in redirection by the pre-cotted plane. It's not as effective as in the right direction. So that probably sort of answers your question.
Well, I still would like to know if the character of the neuroectoderm itself is right. So if you remove this pre-cotted plane, then signaling interactions between that and the ectoderm might be different. I can imagine that, you know, what used to be dorsalized tissue is now ventralized tissue, and the ectoderm behaves differently.
Yeah, yeah.
So is the character of the ectoderm the same, it's just moving differently, or is it, you know, are the cell fates within the ectoderm actually perturbed?
Yeah, so you're talking about mutant, so you're talking about this is a different...
I don't know what the sort of female...
Oh, this is a weak PCB mutant, all patterning on the embryo is essentially coming in these guys.
Okay.
You get all cell fates being used correctly, there's nothing wrong about
okay,
it.
Okay, so the DV pattern of the ectoderm is fine here.
Okay.
Yes.
So in this mutant, you would not expect the neuroectoderm to be affected independently of the precordal plate?
So you would
because if you actually mess up with the intercalation, you would actually expect a direct effect on the neuroectoderm as well.
So you're assuming that in a Wnt PCP mutant, the ectoderm cell movement might be affected. We have no evidence from analyzing the speed of epitopy in this mutant. What can I say? I mean, Wnt level is not being expressed in the new ectoderm itself, but it might act on the ectoderm. So you cannot completely exclude it. I agree with you. I mean, there might be an effect of your ectoderm movement in general by Wnt PCP signaling, which is independent of the speed of the precordal plate being affected. I agree. I'll show you one more case, perhaps, you know, then it becomes a bit clearer.
Can you do transplantations or explain some of wild type versus mutants in these kind of cases?
Yeah, we do. I'll show you that. But I think you're right. I mean, you cannot exclude that these local effects we are seeing above the precordal plate is due to some local Wnt 11 signaling in this region, which I think is very unlikely, but, you know, we can exclude it. Because globally, the movement is fine, right? Okay, so we did the reverse experiment, and what we wanted to do is we wanted to interfere with new ectoderm pupillary movements, so the movement downwards, and then see how that affects the interaction between precordal plate and new ectoderm. The way we are doing it is, we are injecting myosin phosphatase, or the overexpressing myosin phosphatase, only within the yolk cell. And we know from other studies that actomyosin contraction within the yolk cell is important for EVL epithelial movements. And if EVL epithelial movements are being stalled, new ectoderm and ectoderm movements downwards are being inhibited in the cell. Okay, that's sort of the background of this experiment. Essentially, what we are doing is we are reducing epithelial movements of the new ectoderm of these cells. In these embryos, and we are asking how that would affect the interaction between precordal plate and the ectoderm. That is what is happening, and what we find is the precordal plate still moves normally upwards in these embryos, and the effect actually on the new ectoderm is being enhanced. You get very large broadest movements in these cases where we inhibit the movement of the new ectoderm downwards and leave the precordal plate movement upwards unperturbed, right? So in cases where we inhibit precordal plate movements, the effect becomes reduced. In cases where we inhibit new ectoderm, we have actually enhanced effects on the rearrangement of new ectoderm cells.
In these experiments, how are the cells marked?
Usually what we do is we use a transgene, which is expressing GP only in precordal plate cells. It's a goosegood GP transgene. And we are labeling all the other cells which are non-precordal plate with any membrane marker you can label. Okay, so what we ended up with these experiments is we have two different cases. In one case, we inhibit precordal plate movements, still a big Wnt 11 mutant embryos, and we saw that the effect on the new ectoderm movements was being diminished. And we got the opposite when we inhibit new ectoderm movements, and we looked at the effect of precordal plate, normal movement on the new ectoderm was being enhanced. Does it reflect the position of the neural plate, the neural unlier? Because that's what we really wanted to know at the end, and when we look at wild-type embryo, that's where the neural plate is sitting, here. And if you compare, forget about this experiment, but if you compare that to a mutant, silver big Wnt 11 mutant embryo, the precordal plate is shifted posteriorly. And if you look at it, considered active myosin phosphatase embryo, once it has reached, it closes, the neural plate is sitting in the hand. So that's consistent with the idea that the effect which the precon plate exerts in the reactor dome has consequences for positioning of that material. Okay, now we come to the experiment where we can do rescue experiments and to see if we can possibly rescue the experiment we want to do is to see if it's possible to exclude any sort of secondary effects. Is putting Y-type precon plate cells back into an MVU and an MZVP MVU, which has no new underground. Basically, sort of forming a little ectopic precon plate in these MVUs. And then asking if this lonely precon plate sitting in an MVU, which has no new underground, would be able to reproduce the type of movements and the actin we usually see in a Y-type MVU. Okay? Now, that's the experiment. These are the transplanted cells. Unfortunately, what you can see is that the new actin cells just move over them and eventually take them off, right? So they have very little chance to swim against the stream of the new actin cells. We can put something between 20 to 200 precon cells in there. It doesn't change too much. Essentially, in this case, the new actin cell movements downwards, the pivotal movements dominate the precon plate, and the precon plate cannot do its proper job. That's just the quantification. You see that these are the transplanted cells, the green ones, and this is the ectoderm cells. You can see that they're moving down and pretty undisturbed, and they actually take along now the precolor, transplanted precolor plate cells. So that was a bit disappointing. We thought, what can we do to see if there's any rescue possible at all? And what we did is, we combined the experiment we did before, and what we do here is we reduce the ectoderm movements in a MZOP mutant fly, because we knew from the previous experiments that this enhances the effect of the precolor plate on the reactor. And then we're putting back these precolor plate cells, and then we're asking, will these cells be able to do something? And luckily, they did eventually. This is what we've seen. These are the transplanted cells. And you get transient effect where the precolor plate is now able to redirect the reactor cells. Eventually, then, the reactor cells are being dragged down. The precolor plate cells are being dragged down by the reactor cells. So, transiently, we can rescue it, indicating that it's really the presence of the precolor plate cells which does the job on new ectoderm cells. Okay, so I told you a lot about what precon plate can in principle do on new ectoderm, and then the question is how is it doing it, and we thought about the mechanical effect which can happen, and essentially what we thought is that precon plate, between the precon plate moving in one direction, the new ectoderm moving in other directions, you have friction, and that these friction forces arising at the interface are actually causing the redirection, the redirection of the movement of the new ectoderm cells above the precolor plate. This is just to show you what the experimental output and the way we're quantifying it here in these cases is. We're just turning the MVU around. Just don't be confused. Animals now downwards and vegetables upwards. And we're looking at these swirl type movements in a wild-type MVU, which you can nicely see in these velocity profiles here. This would be, again, velocity micrometer per minute, and the direction is shown here by the direction of these arrows, right? So you get these kind of swirl movement. This would be the precon plate moving downwards, and you get the redirection of the new ectoderm cells above the precon plate. This is the experimental outcome. What we then did is we teamed up again with Guillaume in this case and with Sylvia, and we essentially hypothesized what I've told you now, that there are frictional forces arriving at the tissue interface, and that they are actually responsible for the observed cellular rearrangements within the ectoderm. We formulated here a theoretical model based on the physical principle of viscous fluid motion, Stokes flow here, and hydrodynamic systems, a flow Reynolds number. I mean, that's what you would assume in such a case. And we consider the new ectoderm as a 2D viscous compressible fluid, moving the opposite direction of the precolor plate. That's what we're seeing experimentally. And the precolor plate, we basically looked at as a rectangular element exerting friction force on the new ectoderm. And then we are asking, when we're moving now these two elements relative to each other, would that exert effects on the new ectoderm, which are compatible to the experimental observation. Now, that is what we saw experimentally, and that is what we get when we're putting the model in, and that looks strikingly similar for the wild-type case. Here we are assuming pivotal movements and the effect of this precon plate, which is a rectangular element on the flow of the ectoderm cells. Now, what we really wanted to know is we wanted to see if we can get, if we can only look at the effect of the precolor plate on the ectoderm movements, taking away the ectoderm movements, just to see what can the precolor plate do on the ectoderm, irrespective of the degree of the ectoderm movements we have. And essentially what we are doing is we are subtracting undisturbed movements in a Matthäus-Egger-Tabani Pinnock Newton embryo to wild type and just end up with a difference between these two conditions, right? Which should be then caused by pre-trial care. And we can do that again for the model case and the experimental, and we again see a very clear indication that once you have a pre-trial care, this leads to a redirection of these movements right above pre-trial care. Now, what you can do is if you have this, you know, just looking at the effect of the pre-trial plate on the end, irrespective of any degree of the pinion movement for these guys, you can actually quantitatively compare these effects. You can look at the velocity profile along the animal vaginal axis. The pre-trial plate will move in this direction downwards, and so does it here in the experimental case. And then you can look at the velocity profiles along the axis, and you see that the experimental and the simulations are quite closely correlating in this case, indicating that we can, by fitting the parameters, of course, we can get effects on the reactor which are consistent with the idea that friction forces are actually doing the job here. We can do that for all different experimental conditions we have tested. We can do it for control conditions, as I showed you. We can do it in conditions where the movement of the pre-trial plate would be slowed down. And we can do it in cases where the movement of the epimely movements would be reduced, for instance. So essentially, what we from these comparisons between the simulations and the experimental results, what we are ending up is we get additional support to the idea that frictional forces arise at this tissue interface phase, and that they are in principle sufficient to explain the observed cellular rearrangements within the ectoderm. One important parameter we can get out here is the friction coefficient, and that's important for arguing which type of interaction we have actually with this interface. Depending on the tissue viscosity which we are assuming here, you're getting a friction coefficient in the range of 0.6 to 600. And this would be, this is a back of the envelope calculation, would be consistent with the idea that there's cadherin mediated interaction at this tissue interface, assuming that there's approximately 400 molecules per square micrometer on each side. I mean, we don't have the exact measurements, but these are just taken from the literature. The lifetime of a cadherin bond is approximately 2 seconds, and that there's a certain elasticity of the ectodomain of cadherin. So, assuming that that cadherin mediated friction is indeed doing the job, we want to see if you can interfere with that, to see if that is indeed the most likely scenario. But we assume this, and we are just looking at the pre-colored plate. Now we are not looking at the new ectoderm, but the pre-colored plate. If you would have cadherin-mediated interaction at this interface leading to friction, then the movement of the pre-colored plate should be mostly affected right to the interface, and it should be less affected further away from the interface, right? So we are now looking at pre-colored plate. So basically, in a case where we would have cadherin, this would be not as pronounced, right? Because the velocity would not be increasing away from the interface with friction forces being exerted. But we want to see if that is indeed the case. But just turning to an e-cadherin mutant or orphaned embryo and see how this looks like. And this is the pre-colored plate and the velocity profile of pre-colored plate cells. Essentially, from the quantification, what we are seeing is that indeed in wild type, the movement velocity is highest further away from the interface, and it's lowest very close to the interface between the neoactive and pre-colored plate. And this decrease in the velocity as a function of distance to the interface is being very strongly reduced in e-cadherin morphed embryos. Now, using e-cadherin morphed embryos is a bit problematic because once you're getting rid of e-cadherin in fish embryo, everything goes essentially wrong, and you know, you want to do a slightly more specific experiment. What we want to do is the experiment I introduced before is trying to rescue the embryo which has no pre-colored plate of pre-colored plate cells, right? So Matthäus-Egger-Tabani mutant embryos in this kind of sensitized condition where the epimely movement of the new ectoderm are being reduced in the mutant embryo. And what we are putting back now is, in this case, we have put back wild-type cells, which are wild-type pre-colored plate cells, which are at normal levels of e-cadherin. And we do that in the same experiment where we put in cells in which have reduced level of e-cadherin and ask if they would be able to do the same job at the wild-type cells, and they aren't. I mean, there's some effect, but the effect of the transplanted cells, from they don't express e-cadherin or express reduced levels of e-cadherin, is diminished. And that's, again, sort of indicative that this is an e-cadherin-mediated friction between pre-colored plate cells and the ectoderm cells. Okay, so that was all what we put in initially, and then talking to the referees, we're still not completely satisfied. So we had, you know, the question was, is it really friction, or could you exclude that there might be some signal coming from the pre-power plate onto the reactor arm, which does the job? Some, you know, mechanical interaction which you don't understand, and, you know, this is not operation. So what we thought is we do one experiment where we can at least show that friction beyond the simulations is sufficient to induce movements within the new epidermis, which we are seeing, which, you know, look like. The experiment is, again, a very simple experiment. We're taking a cantilever of an Avon microscope here, and we're putting beads on it, plastic beads, gluing them onto the cantilever, and either coat them with ecotherm or don't coat them, just pack non-adhesive. And then we're taking a new ecotherm tissue block, and we're moving the ecotherm tissue block in a velocity which is similar to the pivot movements of the new ecotherm, and we're moving these beads in the opposite direction in a similar velocity as the pre-coupling of the market. And that's sort of the trying to get close to the situation. That's what it really looks like. If this would be the cantilever up here, and that's the tissue, and we're just moving a little bit. And essentially what we found is in these experiments, if you have control beads, this would be the bead movement, and this would be the new ecotherm movement. There's initially some, you know, once we're moving the beads onto the ecotherm, there's some effect, but eventually there's very little effect between these two. They're basically moving in opposite directions, right? Once you have coated these beads, you can see that the coated beads take along the new ecotherm, so this interaction is moving. Okay. And if you look at the flow profile, I mean, this is what we're seeing in a vitamin embryo, where the pre-coupled plate exerts these slow kind of movements, and this is what we're seeing in these ex vivo, ex plant bead experiments, where we essentially can use the same kind of vortex flows within the tissue. Again, this is not excluding any chemical reactions which might do the job, but it's basically just showing that essentially friction would be sufficient to explain. And I think, you know, that's what we can really conclude from these experiments.
Can I ask, the change in the flow field is not local to the beads. It's the whole.
This is beyond the area of the beads. So usually you see the most effect is at the middle of the pickup plate, right? And there the velocity of the new ecotherm is the most affected. And then this propagates out of the region where the new ecotherm overlies the pickup plate. It goes into this large vortex.
So is your feeling then from the simulations that the vortices are somehow driven?
These are not simulations.
No, but I mean, maybe insight from that comes from those simulations. Mm-hmm. The vortices there are being driven as sort of passive hydrodynamic flows, mm-hmm, of the specific movement of a subset of the cells, or does one need to get some sort of collective organization?
You know, what you can calculate is the hydrodynamic length in this experiment. The hydrodynamic length is actually very small, it's only 20 micrometers. Meaning that what you see is happening right at the interface between the pre-coupled plate and the ecotherm. This 20 micrometers, you know, two something on this approximately. And everything which is happening outside the pre-coupled plate in this area is secondary to the, you know, effect you're seeing right above the pre-coupled plate.
Okay, why are we doing this experiment with cells instead of bits?
Yeah,
you know, the time of interaction is showing up to exclude signaling. Really going to.
Yes. I'm not doing it with cells because it's very difficult. We try to do it. Just didn't work, I think. The problem is you have to glue these one cell, you know, the pre-coupled plate, one cantilever, and you have to glue them, the new ecotherm cells here and then move them over each other. I'm not entirely sure what it would really tell you more than what we had. I mean, we tried to use beads to exclude actually any possible secreted ligand coming from pre-coupled plate doing something on the new ecotherm, which is independent of the friction. I think what we cannot exclude in these experiments is that we have some sort of recognition on the other side, right? I mean, there might be something which goes beyond friction, which does change something with the ecotherm, which makes it more motile, God knows what. But it's not really the purpose of excluding now all possibilities, but just showing that one possibility would be a reasonable solution. But we tried this experiment, I recall that it was not easy.
I think it makes some think, but how do you, in your cross sections, you only see ecadherin in the interface, and how do you only get ecadherin localized there versus in the other? Is it only expressed in some subset of cells, or do they not move once they?
So we are not proposing that EKTM was only expressed at the interface between precognitive.
But in your pictures, it was only there, right? Or is it everywhere and it's just enriched there?
I don't think so. I can try to find it again. This is the picture, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have ecoherent. I mean, the red stuff here is ecoherent. But you can see it here. You have it between ecoderm cells and between precognitive cells. It's not only localized at the interface.
Okay.
It's not even enriched at this interface of me. Okay, so I'm pretty much at the end, actually. Questions?
So I think from your first absolute slide, you cannot show that this two-arm evolution happened not only in the place where you showed here, but also I think on the anterior. I think it's the anterior because this is posterior.
So this is
happening on both sides of the embryo, right? These involutions.
Ah, okay.
And you're just analyzing one of the two. And it seems that on the other side, this evolution is much smaller. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go to the first absolute slide of your presentation.
This one?
I mean, number one.
This one.
Okay. I mean, the title.
It's not as sweet. This one? You want to have a completely different one. From the first one?
Like the first one where you show the cartoons at the beginning of the
distribution.
Like slide
one.
Okay,
yeah. Yes, number two, okay. Yes. So it seems that you have two evolutions. You're looking at one, which is on this side, while on the other one, there's still an evolution, but it's much smaller. So if you could compare the two, maybe this will allow you to understand the mechanism which is behind this evolution, right?
Yeah. I mean, essentially what we are looking at is not even... I mean, we are looking at a very specific population of mesenoderm cells, which are the precognitive cells. And these are the cells which are really going ahead of the rest of the mesenoderm, right? They're really ahead. They're a collective group of cells which are migrating up to the animal pole, while the other mesenoderm cells are more loosely arranged cells which are undergoing migration but at a slower pace upwards. So we are only looking at the interaction between precognitive cells and your ecoderm cells, and we are neglecting
the two mechanisms completely.
No. I'm not saying that the other cells would not do something to the ecoderm, but that's not what we have analyzed in this study. They might do something on it, but they are really far behind.
But it's not that there are two sides. This evolution.
No, this is just all around the circumference, right? Yeah, exactly. You have
like
you are
ventral. Focusing on one particular area.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it's on.
So it's all around.
Yeah, exactly.
All around. But it's not the same.
Because it's not all around because the thing is polarized already.
Yeah.
It's like a hat. The edges of the hat are going underneath, all around.
With different
degrees.
Different rates
and
behaviors locally.
So the brown stuff is mesenoderm stuff.
So Cynthia, can you say a little bit more about what you think the local nature of this friction is? I'm just having a hard time imagining locally one cell sort of sliding against another like two pieces of Velcro. Is it something like cells make transient contacts and then break them again? How do you see this friction?
Okay. So if you would assume that there's friction, then you would assume that mesenoderm is not using the new ectoderm as a substrate for migration, because then you would not have friction. Then the whole thing is different, right? If it crawls on the new ectoderm, it would be something different. But what we see is actually, if you look at the leading edge of the precognitive plate, the leading edge cells make contact with the underlying yolk cell. So they seem to contact the yolk cell and crawl on the yolk cell, right? So the interface is more of a passive, if you want, so passive interface between crawling cells, mm-hmm. which use the yolk as a substrate, and cells positioned above these crawling cells, which are moving in the opposite direction. So we have two movements. And these interactions must be short-lived. And actually, if you look at these interactions, they are quite short-lived. They're making contact. They're dissolving contacts, making them dissolve.
On the scale of a pair of cells, so a pair of cells make a transient contact.
Yeah, right? Yep. That's exactly what I said.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's what we see.
Is there a biochemical data, or is the K-off of the multiplicative division?
In this system here?
Well, you mean culture?
I mean, the lifetime is approximately 2 seconds of the K-off. The K-off, I don't know. Of course,
single division. But you have to consider this number with actually. But here,
but it's not the K-off of a single cadherin that matters. It's the off rate of the.
You know,
exactly. It's the sort of the rate at which cell-cell contacts form and dissociate.
But I agree, it's the K-off that matters, right? Because that other phenomenon we are talking about is made of the K-offs of molecular interaction.
I don't know.
I mean, it's the point that he sees that E-cadherin is the molecule that is mediating that.
Right? Yeah. It's just not clear what is the relationship between the, let's say, the local density of E-cadherin and the dissociation rates, the off-rate individual bonds, and the rate at which a pair of cells lose a contact.
But at the end of the day, each individual cadherin need to disassemble.
That's true, but it's not just a function of the off-rate of that cadherin from here, because the contractility of the cell is also influencing.
It could be some complicated.
If you pull a cadherin dimer, it doesn't rip off usually a binding domain, but it rips off the cortical increment. You pull out.
But what's definitely measurable is the mobility of cadherin in the plasma membrane of those cells, which is the relevant.
That's something I'm looking at.
CP, I wonder if you could mimic the prefrontal plate by inserting a bead between the ectoderm and the white the yolk layer. And would that be sufficient friction coated with different things? Would that be sufficient friction to cause the vortices in the ectoderm?
So you're assuming a bead which is not motile, which would essentially just move down within the ectoderm. I think you need some relative movement to accept friction, right? And it's just being
so that's
along,
just gonna be carried.
I mean you have to hang it somehow, right? You could glue it to the oxide, perhaps. And then you have to find something different to glue to the oxide, not to the
I don't actually understand why you need this relative movement for friction. Doesn't it really depend on how tightly they stick to each other? Three-quarter plate cells were just stuck in place, but they had stronger or weaker attachment to these cells moving over them, then you'd have more or less friction.
If you're talking about
friction, then only one of the two cell populations has to be moving.
Yeah, I'm not saying that those have to move, essentially. Yeah. I'm just saying they have to move relatively.
Sure, but if the overlying cells are moving, then you have the relative movement.
Yes, I'm not saying that this is absolutely required. I mean, as long as you have some relative movement, you can. The effect on the reactor is different depending on if you move one or the other also.
I mean, isn't the key effect from the perspective of the ectoderm is that you're displacing a bunch of ectoderm cells in one direction and there has to be a counterflow. And you could do that either by pushing a bunch of cells or by, at the boundary and training the movement of cells. So it could be a friction effect or it could just be some physical object which is big enough that it displaces a bunch of cells, like pushing them ahead of it.
That pushing via the precon plate, right?
Phosphorylation
between these two.
So it's not just you're talking about frictional. You're talking about I guess you have two different layers in this case. So that then there has to be an interface between the two of them.
Exactly.
But if you were to embed a physical object in the ectoderm and move it to displace the ectoderm cells,
so then you would get exactly the physical object and then the ectoderm, right, at the interface.
Yeah, that's right.
So that, might do the same or might do something similar.
Yeah.
That would be the problem.
So I have a question about prechordal plate transplantation. Do you take
I'm sorry. By the way, I mean, that's the experiment we did, right? I mean, moving these beads over the ectoderm is essentially,
So, are you taking up individual cells of the prechordal plate, or are you taking up clumps of cells? And then how do you control the geometry?
So in this case, we are cutting out tissue blocks, little blocks of tissue consisting out of, so 200 grams or something. And then we're taking these intact blocks, put them onto a substrate, which is anchored down there with con A, just to really stick them onto the substrate. And then we have an interface up there where we're sliding over beads all over the surface. And we have to be relatively fast because the new ectoderm cells eventually start to form an EBL on the outside, and then the whole thing becomes impossible.
Okay.
So I would like to go back to the first project you described, about this directional movement of mesenchymal cells.
Yeah.
Are there any other processes in zebrafish or other model systems where you see this rather intercalation or direct movement? I mean, James Sharp has recently described something similar in the vertebrate clinic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So do you think that it's a basic fundamental principle of basically modulating the contractility of the overlying tissue and guiding the underlying mesenchymal cells?
I should say that, I guess. But, you know, I think there are several processes where that, you know, looks very similar. I mean, in wound healing, you have effects which are very similar to that. You have been, you know, the Xenopus and Pygmy, obviously, they have that. Yeah, but also, you know, there was a paper by, we have seen radiant activations as well and surface cell expansion. So it seems to be a conserved mechanism that these two things somehow talk to each other, right? Expansion of surface cells, integration of those cells.
And just an explanation. So this radiant percolation, how does it correlate with the vortices that you see of the ectodermal cells that you described in the second project? Are they related or temporary or?
No, they're not strictly related temporarily. I think what we're looking at here is much later. I mean, here we're looking at 70% of epiphyly. What I showed you before is essentially the onset of epiphyly, right? From 0 to 10% or something. But it's actually a very interesting question because, you know, even at this stage, you might have still some degree of integration. These integrations might have an effect on, you know, which cells make contact to the underlying precordal plate and how long lived this contact actually is.
Thank you.